Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, listeners. This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today is October 24th, 2013, and tonight we're talking with the authors of the book Reading in a Participatory Culture and the complimentary digital book Flows of Reading. I'm your host, Tanya Baker, at the NWP in Berkeley, California. Tonight we will discuss what it means to be a reader and a writer in an increasingly participatory culture. These authors' work exemplify an expanded concept of the term text and model a new type of reader, one who reads across different media and understands reading as an act of sharing, deconstructing, and making meaning. We hope to open a conversation about what counts as reading and all the kinds of reading we perform in our everyday lives. So tonight's show has been pre-recorded. If you are listening to us at airtime, we invite you to join us in the chat room where we will be posting links to materials related to tonight's program. Tonight we're going to talk with Erin Riley, Creative Director and Research Fellow at the Annenberg Innovation Lab at the University of Southern California, Wynn Kelly, Senior Lecturer on Literature at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Ricardo Pitts-Wiley, actor, director, playwright, and co-founder of Mixed Magic Theater, Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Everybody, I'm so glad to have you here tonight. Erin, we're going to start with you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for inviting us.
I think we should jump right in. People are really excited. I'm watching the book, the books spread across the Writing Project like wildfire. But for people who aren't yet familiar with your work, maybe we should just start by talking about the big ideas about text and about reading that your work explores.
Sure. No, we're very excited and appreciative of the National Writing Project helping to spread these two books, which has been 5 years of research that the three of us here on the radio show, including Henry Jenkins, Jenna McWilliams, and Katie Clinton, who aren't able to join us today, have really had the opportunity of collaborating over the past 5 years on really thinking about this new notion of reading and writing and creating a participatory model of reading. So my background and kind of how I come to this project is I'm a media literacy educator. I've actually been in the field with lots of children and teachers and young adults, and really thinking about how media has kind of shaped a new culture of readers. And so when I think about reading in a participatory culture, I think that creating kind of media that's told, creating new narratives that are told across media inspires teachers and students to reflect on what can be considered as reading and what kinds of readings they perform in their everyday lives. So those kids, and even my son's best friend is like this, says, oh, I'm not a reader, you know, because we often denote reading with traditional print literacy and books. And not that we have anything against books, but sometimes for kids of the digital age, the way they begin to understand and identify as a reader is to let them realize that they are reading when they're actually looking at comic books or graphic novels or reading the game that they're playing on the Wii or Xbox or reading the movie that then extends to the book or extends to the television show or extends to even posters out on the wall. I mean, every one of these types of platforms are ways that we engage in reading.
I think that's a really exciting idea, Erin. It opens up so much about what might count as text, but I think it also helps us think about the way we might help kids take a more active stance toward some of those other media that they might not see as them having an active participation in reading or creating meaning with.
That's right. It really helps them take ownership of their learning as they select and pursue their own modes of engaging with the text. And I think what we were trying to do, both in reading in a participatory culture and extending into the flows of reading, is offer teachers multiple examples of putting these approaches into practice. So, you know, our key case study was Herman Melville's Moby Dick, which Ricardo is going to share with you and talk to you about it. He was him and his theater troupe was our inspiration on even starting this project. But what Flows of Reading does is we share a range of additional material and variety of texts throughout the different paths in the Diane book, from David Wiesner's Flotsam, which is a wordless picture book for early elementary children, all the way to J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. And if you think about it, both of those originated as books, but they've had the opportunity to extend into, activities that kids are doing in the classroom by making their own photos and creating kind of their new stories to extend the Flotsam story into their own community. And Lord of the Rings, we know, has spread to beyond the book to movies and through Hollywood.
True. You have jumped ahead to Flows of Reading, and I want to talk a lot more about that. Actually, I think maybe that's exactly where we want to go. So can you tell us a little bit about what motivated you to publish an online companion text along with the print book from your research?
Sure. So we wanted to create Flows of Reading because we wanted to give people an actual space where they actually could engage with the different types of texts we were talking about. The problem with traditional print is that you can talk about a video, but you don't actually get to see the video. You can talk about a photo, but, really being able to do some analysis, being able to embed those kind of annotating and ornamenting on top of an image, it's a very different experience than just reading about it, just talking about it. So Flows of Reading was an opportunity where we could organize the material across four intersecting paths so that people realize that you could read non-linearly and discontinuously, which Wynn kind of has talked a lot about, and how a participatory model of reading doesn't mean that we have to read from page 1 to page 600, but we can in many different ways. And we are able to pursue our own route through thinking about how we engage, whether through our own personal motivations, such as what you're passionate or what you are a fan of, and that's how you begin to kind of drill down deeply into wanting to know everything about those characters or that world that you're reading about. Harry Potter is a good example of that. We always talk about that Harry Potter turned that generation into a generation of readers. And it was because they were personally motivated. They were attracted to the world of Harry Potter, and the book couldn't come out fast enough. So fans started writing their own stories, right? Writing their own kind of counter-narrative. And that's all a way of thinking about developing interpretations and media creations because you're motivated by the reading experience.
No, go ahead.
Well, another way I think that invites readers to apply creative techniques that goes beyond kind of fan passion is the ability to sample or combine media and build upon the original text in the terms of one of our new media literacies, appropriation, or otherwise known as remixing. And without Flows of Reading, we couldn't have really shown MC Lars, who's a nerdcore artist, and how he actually was inspired students to think about Ahab by creating a video and discussing kind of and evaluating a remix of Moby Dick through the lens of kids' theater performances.
That's fascinating. There's so much rich media in Flows of Reading. It's very exciting. I wonder, Erin, if you have noticed anything about kinds of readers who get this experience right away, and if there are other kinds of readers who struggle to read in these non-linear and discontinuous ways.
So I think it actually really applies to Howard Gardner's multiple intelligences. Being able to engage multiple literacies across media, whether it's textual, visual, oral, these are different ways that a student engages. And some students are traditional and they prefer the book and that learn better through alternate modes of communication. And a lesson is most effective when conveyed through more than one mode of expression. And teachers know this through creating differentiated learning experiences. That's how I think we're all trying to encourage new forms of curriculum, is this differentiated instruction. And I think reading in a participatory culture and flows of reading provides a lot of different examples of how teachers can create differentiated learning.
Yeah, I think that's great, because you're talking about, in answer to the question, you talked a lot about students, but I'm wondering about if this is harder or easier for people who maybe didn't grow up. Yes, for them.
Well, I'll give you an example, because we really incorporated a lot of these practices into our professional development program, PLAY, which is an acronym for Participatory Learning in You. And this was a three-part professional development program for teachers, starting with a summer sandbox, which was a rich, intensive 3 to 5 day experience where they began to learn about the new media literacy. And then they did this playing outside the box, where they took those ideas that they learned and then put them into practice in their classroom, videotaped themselves, and then did reflections with their peers in building a kind of a community of practice around a participatory model of PD. And I can tell you about Diego, who was one of our teachers, and he was having a hard time connecting with hard-to-reach students. This was not something that he gravitated towards. I'm like, well, how do I really effectively incorporate media into the classroom, especially considering all the barriers to get media into the classroom? Even though we've said we've, you know, hardwired the classroom, we've addressed the digital divide in schools, we've kind of connected all the schools, but we've left it unplugged. You know, it's not accessible to the internet. There's so many filters that blocks out the kind of rich media that students are engaging in after school.
Right.
So, you know, they need to understand, though, that it's not just the high-end media that addresses these new forms of literacy. But you can do a no-tech or low-tech experience of really trying to think and do and recruit the new media literacy, because these are social skills and cultural competencies. They're ways of thinking and doing that build upon the traditional literacies, such as performance. So Diego had a student, Jack, and Jack was really into Michael Jackson. And he was kind of a disruptor in class, But Diego really wanted to engage him in becoming more fluent in the reading practices. So he convinced Jack to kind of take Michael Jackson and, through Michael Jackson's songs and music, be able to tie it to the school content. It was a real risk that Diego was willing to take, right? To be able to say,
right,
okay, I'm not sure if Jack is going to understand the lesson, because he's not taking it on traditionally. But and surprisingly enough, the principal came in the day that Jack was sharing his work, and so Diego was even more freaked out, like, oh my gosh, this could be a total failure. But what he actually performed a Michael Jackson song for the class and used the song lyrics to draw the class into fluent reading practices, very much like, I'm sure he was inspired by MC Lars and Ahab, that was actually brought into the classroom as well. And when after the song, when Diego actually posed some specific questions to him, reflecting on the actual objectives of the class, he was able to make connections relevant to what his passion was, which was the Michael Jackson, and how it related the reading practices that they were learning in the classroom.
That's a great story. And how did Diego talk about that experience, besides describing it, which is very motivating in itself?
Well, I mean, I think that there are a lot of creative, attuned teachers willing to take these risks, but I think administrators need to be vocal and say, okay, I'm behind you. You know, go ahead, take these risks to try keeping our students engaged. And what Diego says is that this just kind of confirms his the play model, the ability to experiment with your surroundings, to try having students engage in reading and enter it in a different way than what we traditionally do through books, through kind of the traditional, like, read the whole book. And he found that despite the difficulties, you know, it was difficult. It struggled to kind of continue to make the objectives transparent, but he honed in on it being relevant to students, and that joy of students being able to bring in their passions while engaging with the text really made it that much more powerful learning experience.
That's a really powerful conclusion to that vignette, I think, Erin, because I think so much of professional development for teachers tries to take out the struggle of the work, and this is a whole different set of values from this will be easy, or this will be clean, or this will make, you know, learning smooth. You've named a whole different set of values that we'll struggle, but it will be relevant and the learning will be joyous. That's right. That's really a game changer.
I think that these new teaching practices, they're messy, you know, but we should embrace the messiness and be able to say that through that, we make it more relevant, we make it more playful, we engage it to popular culture, to things that kids are enjoying and connecting to their outside of the classroom life. And that makes it more relevant. And I think, you know, Ricardo's going to, you know, I know you're going to talk to Ricardo, but, I mean, that's exactly what he did with, you know, incorporating Moby Dick and working with incarcerated youth and tying it back to their own culture of on the street and what being, you know, a young adult in kind of living on the street was like. And when you make it personal, the reading experience, you remember it more. You know, there's one group that I was judging for Cable in the Classroom a while back, kind of some innovative teachers. And one teacher actually had turned his entire history class for the entire year into a theater performance. So the minute you walked into the classroom, you were performing history. And 4 years later, he went back to those students that he had first done that program with, and they actually remembered the history of that year, more than just if you had learned it in a book.
Yeah, that is really a powerful thing for us to remember. Erin, I think our listening audience who haven't yet read Reading Anticipatory Culture may find themselves surprised to hear you put the title Moby Dick next to adjectives like relevant and playful and personal and joyful. They might not be surprised that you're putting it next to struggle, but I think they may be really chomping at the bit to hear more from Wynn and Ricardo about their work with Moby Dick. And so I want to make sure that we save plenty of time for both of them as well. But before we close out with you, I'm just wondering if there's anything about flows of reading or reading in a participatory culture that you really had hoped to say to the audience today that you haven't had a chance to say yet.
I would just say that flows of reading actually is like an e-workbook. It actually gives you a chance to try out the activities that we developed in the teacher strategy guide and begin to come together as a community of readers. And what I would say is, remember, we started reading, you know, in the arms of our parents, right, and not in school. And there was a joyous moment, and somehow we actually, somehow when we get to the fourth grade, it's not enjoyable anymore, right? And I would say consider the famous Mark Twain expression, don't let schooling get in the way of your education. And reading was one of our first initial ways that we begin to learn. And so we should embrace the kind of passion that we had in early childhood and continue to carry it through the rest of our adult lives.
That's lovely, actually. It's nice to come back to Mark Twain. I mean, it's really very fun to read your work and to hear you talk about your work in the way that there are often these sort of cultural touchstones right there in the middle of so much new and interesting spaces and work. It's just, I think people are going to be, if you haven't read the book or tried out Flows of Reading, read Flows of Reading, participated in Flows of Reading, should definitely do that. Now, I just want to say for National Writing Project teachers who might be listening and who are also coming to the annual meeting, that you and many of your colleagues will be at our annual meeting, that you'll be our keynote speakers, and you'll be talking about this work with us some more, and also that there's a session where they can, if I understand it, try out some things from Flows of Reading. Is that correct?
Oh, definitely. We're gonna, in the workshop, we're gonna actually do kind of do a close reading through one of our lessons that was very much embraced by teachers on appropriation and remixing. So we call it reading with pencil in hand or mouse in hand, or if you're on a tablet, finger in hand.
That's fantastic. I know people are going to be really excited about that. So we in the NWP community, many of us will see you again soon, Erin, and as always, really look forward to opportunities to talk with you and hear about your work. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Tanya.
Wynn, let's turn to you next. You are a senior lecturer on literature at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a renowned Melville scholar. How did you come to be interested in reading and participatory culture and this work with young people?
It's hard for me to say, too. I have a background as a high school English teacher, and even before that, I worked with young kids with learning disabilities. So I've been interested for a long time in young learners and pedagogy in classrooms outside of academics. So when I learned about this project from Henry Jenkins, my colleague at MIT, I suggested he approach Ricardo Pitts-Wiley, whom I'd met through my Melville studies. And I basically stood back and watched while they while the project took off. The work that came out of that meeting was so exciting, and I just wanted to be part of it.
You performed a very important task there, clearly connecting those two people to bring this get this project started. That's amazing. I love the work that you and Henry Jenkins do in the book to lay out some historical view of this concept of what reading is and what counts as reading. I wonder if we could jump into your part in the work, which we know is really actually more than the introductions, and give us a quick tour of that history of what it means to read or be a reader.
Well, it's a kind of a flying history, but we started with medieval scholars transmitting their knowledge to students who were scribes and writing it right down. We called it a model of transmission, simply passing information from one group to another. And also we thought about the Renaissance as a time when information from the ancient world was translated into new languages and became available to people. So we started with these rather static models of learning, and then we sped through the centuries in between. We thought about literacy as a matter of improvement for new readers in the 18th century and early 19th century, people who wanted to raise their class status or their intellectual status by reading. And then we thought about mid to late 19th century ideas of literature as a kind of transport that you read to be carried away, and you fall in love with a book and you create a relationship with a book. And we felt that we still have many of these ideas of literacy now. And we wanted to emphasize that what we call the new media literacies grows out of all these older forms, that what we're talking about is a relationship with a text that does many things and isn't restricted to any one of these. But we thought that giving a kind of historical context would allow people to understand that our practices of reading come from historical and cultural environments.
And that this is not the first time that they've changed or that we've pushed
exactly.
That's great. I think that's really helpful to people who come into this conversation in many of these spaces of thinking about reading. You also talk about what reading means to you as a literary scholar. What does it mean to read like a literary scholar?
Well, I got my sense of that refined by comparing it with what it means to read as a media scholar, which was Henry Jenkins' contribution, and how Ricardo reads as a theatrical artist, and Rudy Cabrera as a student and an actor. So my take on that was that reading is something we all do. But that literary scholars probably think more completely or spend more time thinking about language, the language we use when we read, and especially artful language that seems shaped in some way, again, through social or historical or cultural means, but also by an artist, a literary artist. But my sense of that isn't exclusive. I think in my teaching, I'm always encouraging students to think about how they use language when they write in their own media or for their own purposes, that this is, again, something that's been going on for a long time and isn't restricted to the world of literary scholars.
That's lovely. I mean, it's really great to hear someone who has a lot of could have a lot of investment in a particular way of reading, talk about what it is and what its value is and how it is situated in this great wide world of ways to think about the world.
Well, I had to learn because I was trained with very mid-20th century methods by my father, who was an English teacher, and I know what traditional literacy for that period is about and how I had to find my way out of it as I was exposed to more varieties and of reading practices, and this project really opened that up a lot. So, I had to learn what you're talking about.
And so will many readers of your text, and I mean, so have we all, I guess, if we continue to grow and change and see how our work fits into the world as the world grows and changes. But it's a lovely example that you offer, both in this interview and it probably with more words in the text as well. So I hope everybody's very excited to read Reading in a Participatory Culture for that and many things. I love the way you talk in the book about the fact that you've been reading Moby Dick since the 70s, and you argue that I think this is really interesting, both that reading Moby Dick has changed over these decades, and I think this is a big one, when there's no better time to read Moby Dick. Can you elaborate on that argument?
Yes, although I want to caution against assuming that this just works for Moby Dick, because it works for lots of
good.
Other texts as well.
Thank you.
But I think the main thing we thought about was one of the main reasons we chose Moby Dick is that it's like other great texts that you don't have to read linearly. So if you pick up a Bible or encyclopedia or an anthology or any number of texts that are in our literary canon but aren't necessarily novels, and we realize that novels were invented not too long ago, we don't read them from beginning to end. We don't read them continuously. We don't expect to have a sort of a deep experience with every part of the book. And Moby Dick is particularly hospitable to that form of reading. It's a book you can dip in and out of and move around in. And we thought that our readers, the students in our classrooms, were very used to that kind of reading, which was actually more common in the 18th century than it is now, a form of reading in which you're engaging with a book where you want to engage with it. So we thought it was an interesting test to try that kind of reading with Moby Dick, and I felt that this was a great time to be coming back to Moby Dick through the lens of those new reading practices that come out of digital communities.
Were students surprised to be asked to bring a kind of reading they do elsewhere in the world into the reading of a novel?
Well, I can't speak for the high school teachers who tested the book in their classrooms, but when I've done it in my classroom, they seem so relieved. They seem to be relieved to have the burden lifted the burden of a sort of a, I don't want to mischaracterize traditional literacy because it's been so valuable. And one big theme of the book is that we don't get rid of one literacy when we adopt a new one.
Right.
And we don't get rid of an old technology when we find a new one. So it's not as if close reading and close reading practices are no longer useful. It's that we wanted to suggest that they're open to, and that these texts are open to new ways of reading. So I think students who've been trained in certain very successful reading practices are quite pleased when they find that they're also invited to read a little less literally, a little less linearly, and to draw on the practices they've already learned in their online texts.
That's fantastic. So I'd like to talk a little bit about practices or techniques. How do we teach students to read texts in these ways, in these times? What might a participatory reading look like for individual readers?
Well, we had lots of wonderful ideas and lots of help from education experts who were involved in the project. But one that I've really enjoyed because it has a direct connection to Melville is the use of marginalia or annotation, because Melville did this with all his books. He wrote all over them, and we're lucky to have quite a few of them and to be able to follow his engagement with what he's reading by what he marks, and he wrote lots of comments in the margins. So I've gotten involved in using some both low-tech and digital tools for annotating text in my classrooms, and it gives readers a way to own the text and to interact with it, philosophically or personally. So, you know, with some of the students, we ask them to take the first page of Moby Dick and just react to some of those famous lines. And they came back with, why should we call him Ishmael? Do I have to? And that's the first start. That's the first step in identifying yourself as a reader and developing a voice as a writer and a researcher. So it's a very important, very simple, but critical skill.
That's fantastic. It's so exciting, all this work.
Well, I can tell you it's been wonderful for me as well.
If that's an individual's experience, if we begin to give individuals tools for having some agency with text, being able, feeling like they can have some authority to interact with, ask questions of, how do we, what's that mean for how we organize students to learn together then?
Well, I think that one way students can come together is around understanding the writing process a little bit more, or by doing it themselves, learning what writers go through. And one thing that we tried was thinking about texts as kind of halfway stations between or places where borrowing and lending goes on. So we were thinking of Moby Dick as a book that borrows from older texts like the Bible and Paradise Lost and Sea Shanties and Sailor Yarns, and then has also been turned into, that's the borrowing, and then lends itself to movies and films and restaurants and cartoons and all kinds of other popular forms. So when they see the texts are somewhat in flux within a culture, they see the way that reading as a culture, in the culture of the classroom, can produce creative work. So that's where group projects and collaboration really develop and enrich the reading process. And we don't say you can't go home and get under the covers and read your book alone, but it does, this kind of group experience can make the book social, make it alive. And it reminds us that people used to read together all the time when there was only one reader in the house and everyone else was functionally illiterate. They would sit together and read the text as a group, and we've lost those practices and those habits, but they're really useful for charging up the experience and making it social again.
I have to tell you that I am reading a book by Sarah Vowell called Unfamiliar Fishes, which is about a history of the Americanization of Hawaii, and it's
wow.
Much about New England missionaries coming to Hawaii, but then, of course, the whalers come too. So there's this,
yes.
Suddenly, last night, as I'm getting ready to talk to you, there's this whole chapter about Herman Melville and Moby Dick and New Bedford, and I was thinking, goodness, it's, you do become part of this community, and when you start to think about it, you're sort of stepping into the river of this work and becoming part of it as a reader and as a producer of text. It's, that's just going to go on and on. It's so interesting and exciting.
I'm amazed by that, too. And it's particularly ironic, given that the book was not famous when it was published, and it wasn't discovered until 70 years pretty much after it was written. And then it was canonized and treated as a great American text. And now you have so much more of this, what you're talking about, this sense of community that is enabled by these reading marathons that take place online. Kickstarter projects for producing a Melville, a Moby Dick game that involve hundreds of thousands of people, and none of this was possible. I think Melville would be just tickled by all of this, and it was really part of the vision of the book. One of the reasons I felt the project was really a good fit for this text.
Well, as I keep telling everyone, when it was my favorite project, in teaching and learning that I read last year, I think it's very exciting bringing together this very traditional canonical text with these really, really on the edge, cutting edge visions of what it means to be a reader and to participate in a culture of reading. And I'm just so thankful to you for this work, and I'm thankful to you for being here on the radio today. As we've begun to talk about organizing students to learn together, sort of the last stop here in our interview, it seems like a great time for us to bring Ricardo into the conversation, as he and his work probably not only exemplify but amplify the importance of thinking about a community of learners and how they work together and the range of what's possible, organizing readers to read and learn together. But before I do bring Ricardo in, I just want to thank you so much for your time today and for this really great and exciting work.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Great. So Ricardo Pitts-Wiley is an actor, director, playwright, and the co-founder of Mixed Magic Theater in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Ricardo, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
And can you tell us a little bit about your work and the Mixed Magic Theater?
Well, as you said before, I began my career as an actor and involved in his directing, and then it was important to be able to determine the work that I wanted to do, so I became a theater co-founder. But recently, my work has gravitated away from being just a performer, and I've become much more involved in adaptation of classic literature and with a real strong interest in encouraging young people and whole communities to read more things and allow literature to become a more important part of their life. But the way to do that, I found, was through what I was doing as an actor. Just to get a person to read a book was one thing, but to get a person involved with a book and the learning process, that was more important. And the theater was an avenue that has served me very well in that respect.
Everyone else who I've had the opportunity to talk to about this work, who's worked with you, really come back to your work with Moby Dick as the being the center of this book and of work that you've done.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because although, you know, I had a concept and an idea that I was moving forward with Moby Dick, when I met Wynne Kelly first and the members of the Melville Society, it was a level of scholarship and became involved in the process that really ignited an even greater passion for me and for the people involved. And then when we all met Henry Jenkins and the work that was being done in new media literacies at MIT, we realized that we were actually doing something. We were taking something that was really being theorized about, you know, in academia, and actually putting it to practice. And so it was a perfect storm of theater, community, academia, and new concepts in learning and trying to reshape the way that young people learn. But I was also very much invested in not just young people, but how the whole communities learn. And Moby Dick was a great vehicle. It involved people from every walk of life. He had a great text to work with, a difficult text to work with, but a very accessible text to work with also. And the theater was the thing that allowed all of those elements to come together.
That is so fascinating. I actually love the way that you talked about your work, Wynn's and Henry's, informing each other's. And I'd actually like to come back to this idea in the end and maybe step back a little, if you don't mind, into your own relationship with Moby Dick and the kind of how you got to the work that you did in Mixed Magic Theater. In the book, you talk about a sort of lifelong relationship to Moby Dick. Would you be willing to share some of that history with our audience?
Absolutely. My mother wrote a Moby Dick report when she was in high school in Mississippi that got ruined by her brother when he was shaving, and she had to write it over again. So it was a story that she told often when I was growing up. And my family would gather whenever the Gregory Peck Moby Dick movie came on. We watched it together. So there was a sense of that piece of literature being a part of our lives from early in my life. I was away from it for a long time. And then when I came back to it, I already felt like I had a sense of ownership of the work. But then when you start to read the novel, you realize how difficult it is, and I was so proud of my mom for having written a book report on it, you know, 40 years after she wrote it. I was like, wow, Mom, you were the bomb. And but also, this is a black school in Mississippi, in a segregated black school in Mississippi, in which reading Moby Dick to her was a part of the curriculum and not as daunting a challenge to her at that time as it seems to be now for many contemporary audiences, student and adult. And there's something to be said about the quality of education in some of those segregated schools, because there was an expectation that you would be able to digest the literature and understand it. And I think that's something that's a little bit missing from contemporary education and learning, is that I think we've removed the expectation that you should be able to understand and digest the material. But also, when I started the work on actually putting together, I knew I had to find a way to make it relevant to a contemporary audience. You see, 45 or 50 years ago when my mother read it, it was relevant in a different way. Because I think that her professors and teachers understood that it opened up their students and their readers to the entirety of literature worldwide. And we still have to do that. It was expected to be a lifetime relationship, just like the Bible. And it wasn't about passing a test. It was about investing in text, and I think we kids will read Moby Dick now, they just want to get to the end of the book and pass the test and get on with it. When I approached the work, it was to say, how can I make this a relevant work for a young audience, a new audience, but also how can I invest them in a lifetime experience? And see, that's what the theater does when it's good. When you see a play in a good play, you don't walk out the door and it's forgotten. You walk out the door and you know that there's something that's a part of your life for the rest of your life. And I think the work that Henry was doing with the new media literacies and so on further enhanced it and supported that, because it was saying, and not only is it a part of your life, look at how many parts of your life it shows up in.
Yeah.
You know, there's Moby Dick shows up in Star Trek. Moby Dick, you know, incorporates elements of Hamlet and Shakespeare. Moby Dick, you know, it gives chapters after chapter on cetology as a science.
Yeah.
It circumnavigation of the world. It's not just about a vengeful quest for a whale. It is about really appreciating knowledge and trying to find young people, get young people invested in knowledge acquisition. It doesn't all have to. It's not about a test. It's about being able to use knowledge in your everyday life. If that made any sense, what I just said.
That's so true. I mean, actually, there's so many things in what you said I want to respond to. I can see this interview could go on forever, but I'll try to make sure that it doesn't. I'll be respectful of your time. But I think there are a couple really important things. I mean, one is that I talked to Wynn earlier today, and I told her, I, in getting ready to interview you both today, I am reading a book by Sarah Vowell called Strange Fishes, or Unfamiliar Fishes, sorry, which is about the history of the Americanization of Hawaii. So there's New England missionaries, and then there's whalers, and then the next thing you know, there's a whole chapter on Herman Melville and New Bedford, Connecticut, and I was going to talk to you today. I was like, it really is one of those works that's everywhere, and once you see it, you see it.
Well, the whaling industry and shipping in general, but the whaling industry in particular, probably did more to connect the world than the internet has done. People went places that they had never gone before. There were relationships developed that had never existed before. It was, you know, for as positive as the human contact was, it also brought a lot of negativity with it because it set in motion the destruction of many cultures, and including the Hawaiian culture, the Polynesian culture.
Right.
When the whaling industry was in decline, whaling ships became slave ships. And, Africa was brought, you know, was practically destroyed. It has rebounded, but it took 400 years for it to rebound. On the other hand, it brought people face to face with things. And we learned the body of knowledge, of world knowledge, increased dramatically. But sometimes when we want to look at world history, and this is where new media learning becomes very important, where you can say, if you want to know aspects of world history, you could follow the whaling industry and it'll take you everywhere, because whalers went.
Right.
Everywhere.
Right. I think the connection between whaling and the internet is fascinating. So that brings me to a question, because clearly this book, Moby Dick, is a rich book about a rich time and facet of history. Can the kind of work that you do, describe, that you do in Mixed Magic Theater, and that you all worked on when you wrote Reading in a Participatory Culture, can this kind of work lots of literature, any literature?
In other literature?
Yeah.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm more compelled now than ever to expand on and demonstrate that what we did with Moby Dick can be done with lots of kinds of texts. Since Moby Dick, I've done an adaptation of Don Quixote using the same methodology. I've done a production of Frankenstein. In fact, I'm about to do that again in April of next year, a furthering of that project. And in fact, it's called the Frankenstein Literacy Project, you know, where you take a great piece of work, you look for a contemporary angle to work with, but you also try to stay as true to the original text as you possibly can. And you also have to be able to deal with big questions. You know, in Don Quixote, the big question is the nature of honor. The knight errant as an honorable warrior for the downtrodden and the helpless. Whereas Frankenstein is about what is the nature of monster making, who's doing it, how does it happen, what are the ramifications of monster making, and one of the things about Shelley's text is so much of the events unfolded because Victor Frankenstein refused to take responsibility for what he did.
Right.
And in my version, in my adaptation of the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, the narrative is so much introspective. It's like Hamlet. He's thinking about what's happening. He's not doing a lot of things. I mean, there's some great moments of action in the work, but a lot of it's introspective. You know, so I had to kind of re-look at how I was going to do that one, and I wrote a play called The Original American Icon, in which Frederick Douglass has been nominated as the original American icon, must go before a Senate committee. He brings us his lawyer, Abraham Lincoln, but the chief questioner on the Senate panel is John Brown, and they play. And John Brown is cast as Fortinbras from Hamlet. Frederick Douglass is the player king from Hamlet, and Abraham Lincoln is Hamlet from Hamlet. And they play out this whole scenario of his life and times and what happened, and John Brown's position is, you know, both of you were sitting on the sideline, you know, waiting for, you know, for something great to happen. You know, I kicked it off. You know, I went to Harpers Ferry and said, we're either going to fight on Wednesday or Thursday. Why not Wednesday? And, you know, while you were being deliberative, Lincoln, and thinking about what you had to do, it had to get going. Douglass, his thing with Douglass is you were a great orator. You talked about it. You were emotional. You were passionate and all of that. But I started shooting, and things changed. But then, as you go through it, you start to see where John Brown was a crazy man, but a passionate man.
Right.
You know, Lincoln was the right person at the right time. And had it not been for Douglass, there might not have been as a powerful, articulate voice for abolition. And proof positive that you can't make hasty decisions about the capacity of black people to manage and care about their own lives. So when you do the kind of work that we do at Mixed Magic, we not only respect the original work, we also say, how do you make it accessible, and how do you include the entire community? You know, we invest a lot of time and energy, particularly in the theater, in 16-year-olds. And
so could you talk to us, I know we don't have a lot more time, but could you talk to us a little bit about that, particularly because, you know, I think all through your work is this sense of accessibility for everyone and also the responsibility and the work required to on your part to make things accessible. But what particular sort of tools or strategies or ways of working with literature do you think the theater arts bring to this project?
Well, I think the theater arts, it demands that you understand language, one, and it demands that you set up an arc, a trail that takes you from one thing to another. And also, the work that the theater does also is, you know, and I think we did it very well with both Frankenstein and Moby Dick so far, is you have to build in rewards for actually reading the work. Even if it takes you 20 years, build in a reward system that says, our production of Moby Dick, There are scholars who sat and looked at the play and said, oh, my God, that's in chapter 114. Well, that, you know, and because they knew it, they got a reward for it. Also, you know, many years ago, the Bible and Shakespeare were the common document, you know, the common literature among Westerners, English-speaking people, and others, but mostly English-speaking people. Everybody knew something. You know, the Bible was the common thing. Grandparents read it, parents read it, kids read it. And there was an expectation of learning. There was a way to share information that was multi-generational, multicultural even. And I think we have to find ways of investing people in ways that says, not only do we want the 16-year-old to read it, we want their parents to read it too. We have to find ways of creating conversations within households, not just get a good grade on this thing so you can go to a good college. And that's why we – and you also have to be able to know that it, once you create Moby Dick, what we did with it, you're going to have to live with it for the next 30 years. You
yeah,
know, because,
responsibility,
because you've got
doesn't
to give people an opportunity to see it and embrace it. And you know, already, you know, we're only 7 years in, and we've had kids go from being the young people on the train to being adults on the ship.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you know, and at some point, the kid who plays Q, you know, like Rudy Cabrera did, one day he's going to play Ahab.
Right.
And do you know what the most produced play in the history of American theater was for up until the last 10 or 15 years?
Oh, I don't.
Uncle Tom's Cabin.
No.
Yes.
Really?
There was a time when two or three companies a month left out of New York, and whole families that only did Uncle Tom's Cabin for 40 or 50 years, where kids grew up and became adults doing Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, look at the danger of that. There were no black people in any of those productions.
Oh,
so whatever the attitude, prevailing attitude of that company was the image that people got. So if you're out in Nebraska, out in a, you know, in some small town, and a traveling company comes and does Uncle Tom's Cabin, a guy puts on blackface and, you know, and does a certain image, that's totally inaccurate. But it's theater.
Yeah. Right.
And it has power, and it can leave indelible images. In the same, no different than Birth of a Nation, left an indelible and inaccurate, damaging image on a whole multiple generations of people. Well, now we have to, you know, and one of the things about academics and the new media literacies, which is very important, and we talk about it openly with Henry and Wynn and I, is you've got to add the artist into the mix and not after the fact.
Right.
Because what artists do when they do their job well is take that great information, that great ideas, and say, how do we make it accessible and a living thing?
Ricardo, it has been amazing talking to you. I'm so excited that you're going to join us at the National Writing Project's annual meeting next month, and we'll get a chance to meet face-to-face, and also we'll get to hear more of your thinking about this work. Thanks so much for being with me today on the radio. It's been fantastic.
Listeners, this broadcast is part of Connected Educator Month, happening the entire month of October. In recognition of your listening to and engaging with this broadcast, you get a digital badge. To claim your badge, go to badges.connecteducators.org and enter the badge code NURE122. Thanks again to all of our guests, and have a good night.